This is an ABC podcast.
In the lift, on the way up to the lockup. Here we go. It's Richard, 80, A-E-D-Y.
Richard, before you come in, I've just got to...
Take my phone.
Take your phone, yep, and give you some information.
Should I turn it off?
Yes, please, or flight mode or...
I'll turn it off.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you very much. So welcome to the...
Thank you.
Budget lockup. My name is Vishali, I'm from Treasury, and I'm just going to give you a quick overview of how the lockup is running.
There's quite a list of what you're not allowed to do in a lockup, and if you have to do some things, under what conditions you can. Hello, this is The Money on Radio National, and wherever you get your podcasts, I'm Richard Adie. Today, a couple of stories from the budget and one from the pandemic. One of the themes of the budget was job creation, driving down unemployment. Already, it's bounced back remarkably from last year. It's 5.6%. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, says he wants that number to begin with a 4. And that's a good idea. For starters, more people would have jobs. But there's also another reason, wages growth. There hasn't been any for most of the last 10 years. But if we can get the unemployment rate low enough, that will change, apparently. Sarah Hunter's the Chief Economist at BIS Oxford Economics.
To get wages growth going in an environment where inflation expectations are really well anchored, so we all think that prices are going to go up by around 2-2.5% every year in the sort of longer term. To get wages growth going in that environment, you really do have to get the unemployment rate right down to very low levels, to these full employment levels. And what we've seen in Australia pre-COVID is that the RBA, the Treasury, thought that that might be around 5%. It wasn't. We got the unemployment rate there, but we didn't get the wages growth. And if we look at the other countries around the world, the US and the UK, in the US, the unemployment rate had to fall to 4%, actually got below that.
Yeah, I think there was a 3 in the front.
Exactly. So that just tells you that there's global shifts that mean 4% maybe is where we should be targeting. And it may even be a little bit below that to start the process. So the Treasury's 4.5% actually possibly is a little bit high. We might need to go further than that to get wages growth going.
What we saw in the budget was the government's forecast for the wage price index, which is a measure of this, will barely shift, even as unemployment gets to, say, 4.5%. I think they're looking at 1.5% growth next year, 2.25%. This is for wages in 22-23, 2.5 in 23-24. These are pretty meagre numbers.
Yeah, they are. They're certainly, I mean, compared to history, they're very, very slow pace of growth. I think also, though, more importantly, compared to inflation, they're pretty meager increases in wages. In real terms, that number for next year is a pay cut. So that means prices will probably move by more than wages if that forecast comes true. I think it just gives you an indication that that 4.5% is a good target to have, but perhaps it's not low enough. Real wages growth, I think, is important. It's important, obviously, if on an individual basis, because that's what means that we're all becoming better off and making progress. I think it's also important because it's how we capture productivity growth and pay that back, if you like, to workers. So, but we can only get there if we get to a point where everyone that more or less that wants a job has got a job. So when businesses are looking to expand and grow capacity, they can't just bring people in at the current wage rate. They have to increase wages. And that's the kind of dynamic that the RBA certainly are looking to generate through the economy.
Yeah, this is getting rid of or trying to reduce what's called the slack in the economy. And you've already touched on this, Sarah. It's not just unemployment, which we measure fairly easily. It's underemployment, for which our numbers are probably not as robust.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I'd also throw into that actually the participation rate as well. So I think this is what's been really interesting over the last few years, how we measure that degree of slack in the economy has actually changed too. We used to just focus on the unemployment rate. It was a sort of one nice clean metric, if you like. We'd have a look at that. And there was a pretty good relationship between that and wages growth. But what we're seeing is that the labour market's becoming much more fluid. And so the underemployment rate, that's people who have got work but want to work more hours, is a reflection of slack in the economy. And so if we've got people who want to work more hours, then businesses can ask them to do more of the work. Again, they don't have to necessarily increase wages. We've also seen, though, that the response to increased demand for workers from businesses, again, pre-pandemic, was that a lot of people would go from being not in the labour force. So that means they weren't working, obviously, but they also weren't actively looking for a job. Those people saw a job that they liked, it fit really well. They then came into the labour force and took that job. So we also have to worry about the participation rate and where that needs to get to. So there's a sort of a group of people that aren't formally looking for a job right now, but who probably would take a job if it was the right job. We need to get them into work too. So there's actually a few different metrics to capture this slack. And it is a much bigger pool of people than just that one headline unemployment rate suggests.
Yeah, but that headline point, we can't just get to the inflection point, can we, where this begins to change. We'd have to go past it. We'd have to go to a lower unemployment rate to really see wages growth sustained. It's no good just sort of nudging it, just glancing at it. We have to go past it, or we won't really see anything that's sustainable.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. When economists talk about this natural rate of unemployment, what they're talking about is a rate where inflation doesn't accelerate or decelerate. So the pace of inflation, pace of wages growth stays the same. So you can see where we are now. We obviously then would want to go beyond to sort of almost kickstart the process, and then have the RBA start to gradually tighten interest rates and take the foot off the accelerator, as it were, to make sure that inflation doesn't pick up too much, gradually bring it back.
Actually, I think some people have argued that changes like the rise of the gig economy, increasing precariousness of a lot of work, might mean that we don't know if this will work, that maybe we'll get down to where this number is and find that we have to keep going.
It's not impossible, certainly. If you'd asked economists in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis, where did the unemployment rate need to get to in the US to get back to, full employment, wages growth materializing, most economists probably would have said something like 5%. As we've already touched on, the reality was that, no, it needed to go much lower than that to get wages growth going. And part of that is those structural shifts in the labor market that you mentioned, that's become much more flexible. And this has come with a lack of pickup in wages growth at any given unemployment rate. I do, though, think that there is a rate that will mean we get wages growth. If we continue to push the economy hard through fiscal policy, through monetary policy, and push it well beyond that rate, we will see wages growth pick up. But I do think that we have to go much further than we were pre-COVID, which is why I think some of the policy announcements are so important. It's not enough to get the economy back to pre-COVID, which is more or less where we've got to right now. We have to go well beyond that to get to that full employment, to use up that slack.
Yes. Is there anything else that the government could do to get wages to rise? I'm wondering about something like, say, removing the public sector wage freeze, that kind of thing.
That sort of relationship can certainly help in the near term. There's definitely relationships between public sector versus private sector. If you're thinking for a number of workers, there's a choice on where they work, that their type of job that they do, there's public sector demand for it and there's private sector. So there is a cyclical component and it can cut both ways. But if it's not going to come through the public sector immediately because of some of those wage freezes, then the onus will be on the private sector demand to get that growth in wages to start there and then feed through.
As I said earlier, the Treasurer says he wants unemployment rate with a 4 in the front of it. I think the RBA has actually been a bit more ambitious and said perhaps we need to get it down to 4, but with this in mind.
I think that's right, yes. And I think that probably just highlights that we're always learning all the time about the economy and it's always changing and evolving. So what you knew and understood about 20, 30 years ago, not all of that applies today. So their thinking is evolving all the time. But I think that does highlight that they've looked at the last decade, both here and globally, and seen these trends play through. And for them, it's pretty clear that, yeah, 4.5 is probably not going to be low enough, and that it's going to need to go beyond that. And with that in mind, I think that's where their very clear signal on policy and when they expect to be raising the cash rate and tightening in general is it's a long way away from where we are now.
Sarah, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you.
Sarah Hunter is at BIS Oxford Economics, and this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. The budget was about jobs and the pandemic, and getting the government re-elected. But there were mentions of housing. It kept coming up. And the thrust of them was to make it easier for people to buy a home. Rachel Ongvi-Forge is Professor of Economics at Curtin University.
Overall, the budget was really about sustaining the economic recovery through the pandemic. But, you know, the unfortunate thing is that when you have such a huge reduction in interest rates to try to boost employment, along with other fiscal stimulus measures, house prices do start to run away. And they did have to put forward some measures to try to address that. And I would say they're rather like Band-Aid measures. But they did try to basically assist people, do something to assist more people into home ownership.
One of these measures is an extension of something that was there already, the First Home Super Saver Scheme. It allows people to access their super, just the voluntary contributions bit, to help put together a deposit. Lloyd Edge is a buyer's agent at Australian Property Professionals.
Yeah, that's right, Richard. It was previously at $30,000, and I think it's actually a good move putting it up to $50,000 because with the way property prices are going, you actually need to get a little bit of a larger deposit together. And a lot of people are really struggling to get that deposit together because people generally can hold down a mortgage if they've got an income, but getting that deposit together is the hardest thing. So putting that up to $50,000 is definitely going to help. The problem I see with that, though, is that potentially can also keep property prices increasing as well. So it could mean that the, you know, first home buyers and things are still going to be priced out of the market. So it's not necessarily going to solve all those problems.
Yeah, so this is a scheme first introduced a few years ago now, I think 2017. And what they allowed was young people wanting to buy a home to dip into up to $30,000 of their voluntary contributions. What this does is take it to $50,000. Mm-hmm. What effect might it have? I mean, I'm kind of wondering if it's a step towards further changes, in fact.
Yeah, I think that's the concern because at the moment the scheme is only restricted to voluntary contributions. So there has been an attempt made at restricting it. So one could say that it's quite a restrictive scheme. You have to save more into your super voluntarily to then be able to take out more for home purchase. But of course, we know that the government or various politicians or policymakers have been flagging about the use of superannuation for home purchase for quite a number of years now. And that sort of proposal seems to be gaining some momentum, at least in terms of the amount of debate that it's generating. And so if this particular scheme is kind of a first or second or third step in what is really an intended drive towards asking people to dip more into their superannuation for home purchase, then I think that would be a concern.
This is at the moment, of course, as you know, limited to voluntary contributions only. Have you acted for any buyers who are already accessing up to 30 grand that way?
Yes, I have acted for a couple of buyers who have done that, and they have been able to, you know, access that money and put that together with some other savings. It's generally for people who have not been able to buy in, you know, the more expensive capital cities. So these are sort of people who are living more regionally, because at the end of the day, if you wanted to buy, say, a home in the Sydney market, you need a lot more than that $30,000 or the $50,000 in deposit anyway. So it's only going to assist for that. When you're buying regionally, if you were to go, for example, to a place like Orange, where the median house price is $451,000, and you know you can get in there with sort of a $40,000 deposit plus your stamp duty and things like that, you've got a better chance of buying a home.
The government's also expanding the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme. Under it, a new buyer would only have to find a 5% deposit, with the government acting as guarantor for the next 15%, thereby avoiding mortgage insurance and the cost that comes with it.
That's a good scheme. I'm really for that scheme. But again, there's about 120,000 first home buyers each year, so it still limits the amount of people that have access to it. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. It's the same thing. You still need to be able to sustain the mortgage for the property and everything, but it just allows people to get into that market. Getting into places like, Sydney and Melbourne are probably going to be quite difficult. But if you're getting into some of those regional areas where the property prices are cheaper and the deposit's less, then that can really help. Having said that, the way the markets are going at the moment, even the regional areas are getting a lot of growth and the markets are really, really taking off at the moment. So, that's something to watch as well.
Rachel Longview-Forge agrees the scheme has merit.
I think from first home buyers' perspective, it would be a good idea because obviously, and they wouldn't have to pay, those who actually managed to get into one of those extra 10,000 places wouldn't have to pay the mortgage lender's insurance and can just put in a 5% deposit to be able to get into homeownership. Look, I think the scheme is quite contained. It's quite small, which means it will help some first home buyers, but it won't help most of them. It's probably most likely to help people who would have bought anyway. You probably have people who would have been able to save up enough within the next 1 to 2 years, but now with the help of the scheme, they can actually get in earlier. So I call this the displacement effect, which means you're not really helping people who wouldn't otherwise be able to get in to the homeownership sector. You're just helping people to bring forward their home purchase, who would have been able to anyway without help.
Now, 100,000 more spots have been created for single parents to purchase a home with a 2% deposit. Is that helpful?
This, I think, is absolutely fantastic because again, like I was saying before, the hardest thing is actually getting that deposit together for a home. So I guess the thing about this is you still need to be able to borrow 98% of the property's value and the government will then guarantee the rest of that deposit. So if you're on a reasonably good income, you can and can sustain that mortgage. That'll actually work quite well, particularly for single parents who've got two or three kids and they simply just can't get ahead with their savings. However, I still think that's going to be limited a bit there because there's about 1 million single parent families in Australia and 79% of them are actually women. So I still think that this could actually go further to help more people, but it's certainly a good start. And 2% does mean that you can get into do the market much easier.
The scheme is called the Family Home Guarantee. And of course, given the politics of the last few months, it's very much framed as helping single women in particular. But Rachel, is it going to do that?
Well, again, if you are a single parent who is actually earning enough to be able to meet the mortgage repayments, then it is a very good deal to be able to address the deposit hurdle by paying just 2% of the deposit required for the home purchase. So there will be some single parents who will help. But I think when you look at single parents as a whole, I think the majority of them are actually people who are renting and who may not have anywhere near enough to be able to get into the homeownership sector or even meet mortgage repayments after that, because lots of single parents are just working part-time. Because remember, one of the criteria of the scheme is that you have to have a dependent child under a certain age. So that there may be some caring responsibilities there that prevent people from being able to work full-time when they're single parents, which also impacts on their ability to meet mortgage repayments. So I would say if you were trying to help single parents that may be looking at what's happening in the rental sector and the affordability and tenure insecurity issues there would be a more helpful way forward than putting forward a scheme like the Family Home Guarantee.
You're a buyer's agent, Lloyd. Are you acting for anybody who's trying to do this? Single parent only has a very small deposit, now able to access the market with just a 2% deposit?
Yeah, so this is a new scheme that's coming with a 2%. So I haven't actually dealt with anyone who's accessing this right at the moment, and it just comes in July. But I am dealing with a lot of single parents who do need to try to get into the market and for home ownership. And part of my job is to give them strategies on how to save the deposits, how to get ahead, what markets they can buy into. So I can see that over the next few months, this will really come into fruition. I'll be able to help those people.
The government will lower the minimum age for the downsizer super contribution from 65 to 60. This will allow Australians nearing retirement to make a one-off post-tax contribution of up to, I think, $300,000 per person or $600,000 per couple when they sell the family home. That's the thinking. What do you think of this? Do you think it'll encourage older people to sell?
I think it will encourage some people. I don't think it'll necessarily encourage a lot of people. It's not going to make a lot of difference to the markets. The thing is that it used to be for Australians aged 65 years and over. They've just dropped that down to Australians who are 60. So it hasn't made a large difference to who's eligible for it. It'll help some people because, you know, I do come across people who are asset rich and cash poor, so to speak. So being able to sell down the family home and then access that money, put it into super, will help some people. But I don't think it's going to make a huge difference to the markets or suddenly have a whole heap of people selling their homes and increasing the supply of properties on the market or anything like that.
And Rachel Longview Forge agrees. She says that this is an idea that works in theory.
The downsizer contribution is a way of encouraging older people to unlock some of their housing wealth and shift that into superannuation for consumption. So we know that there's many older people who actually own homes that are of quite high values, but the wealth is just locked inside the family home. So in principle, if you can encourage people to downsize, release some of that wealth and push it into their superannuation, then you'll be assisting them to tap into their housing wealth to be able to fund their spending needs in old age. But again, that's the idea in principle. I mean, in practice, there are actually some other problems with such a scheme. And I expect that the take-up of this downsizer contribution scheme will be quite low simply because there's actually quite a number of barriers to downsizing itself that would discourage people from selling up and releasing housing equity.
Rachel mentioned barriers like the tax privilege position of the family home when it comes to aged care assessment or paying stamp duty on the new downsized property. There's a few of these. So what else could the government have done about housing in this budget? What are the opportunities that were missed?
I think there were probably other options. And the interesting things that weren't mentioned at all, things like negative gearing and capital gains changes. And generally, that's because governments generally don't like to talk about that stuff when they've got an election coming up. And I think that this sort of budget is heading towards an early election and things. So there's a lot of structural reform. And I think there's things that need to be done in terms of really getting out there and increasing the supply of housing and trying to level out these house price increases. I heard a lot this year about lack of supply, lots of buyer demand, lack of supply in the markets, people missing out. But that's something that the government really needs to address.
I think instead of trying to implement restrictive band-aid solutions that are pretty much quite heavily focused on accessing home ownership, the government should be taking a look at the bigger picture. So the home ownership sector is big, yes, that's right, and most people still aspire to become homeowners, but we can't ignore the fact that the rental sector is a sector that is in need, a sector where that's overrepresented by lower income people, and a sector where there is significant rental stress and insecurity. The main payment or assistance payment that the federal government makes to low income private renters is the Commonwealth Rent Assistance. That's been repeatedly found to be poorly targeted and inadequate because that as well has not kept pace with rent increases. So if they were looking to spend some money on improving people's housing outcomes, I would argue that those who are on low incomes and renting and suffering from rental stress might be a more appropriate group to target. And there's scope there certainly for reforming rent assistance and increasing it to assist renters.
Rachel Longview Forge from Curtin University, and you also heard from Lloyd Edge from Oz Property Professionals. This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts.
How's everybody feeling today? Welcome to Vax Live, the concert to reinvent the world. Look at all these beautiful people. We're all here in the same room.
In America, they're celebrating. Half of the population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccination.
Well, she's here with me tonight and she's vaccinated.
The Money's producer, Belinda Sommer, has been looking at some of the incentives from the world of behavioural economics, which are being used to motivate people to get a shot. Hi, Belle.
Hi, Richard. You may have heard about the free donuts, free football, baseball tickets and booze that have been on offer to Americans. And there's also been small amounts of cash. For instance, the state of Maryland has been offering state employees $100 to get vaccinated. And that's in a state where the rollout's been really successful. To underline how much effort's going into this, here's Maryland's Governor, Larry Hogan.
As part of our No Arm Left Behind initiatives, we continue to have more than 3,000 points of distribution. We have now expanded to 665 pharmacies and 271 doctor's offices. Our equity task force has now completed over 350 missions. We continue to have 13 mass vaccination sites open and fully operational all across the state. Direct scheduling remains immediately available at all of these state sites. You can also walk up or drive through at any of them with no appointment and immediately get your shot.
In other states, rates of vaccination are not as high. So West Virginia, for instance, is offering $100 savings bonds to 16 to 35-year-olds to boost vaccination rates. But this week, Ohio's Governor Mike DeVine raised the stakes by announcing a state lottery that will put all vaccinated adults into a draw to win $1 million. Now, there are five draws, that's $5 million, and he's announced another draw for vaccinated young people.
We will announce the winner of a drawing of all those 17-year-olds and under who have been vaccinated, and the winner will receive a full four-year scholarship to any one of our state universities. This will include tuition, room and board, and books.
So that seems like a really big incentive. Why so much?
It's because the pace of inoculations in the US, they've tailed off in recent weeks. And US President Joe Biden has set a goal for the 4th of July. He wants to see 70% of all Americans to have had at least one shot by that important date. So the problem at one stage, we'll all remember, was getting enough vaccine. Mm-hmm. Now it's about motivating people who are slow or reluctant to have the vaccine. And that's where some powerful tools from behavioural economics can help. Financial incentives, they can help people who are thinking about doing something. You know, they're interested in maybe getting the jab. Yeah. And a monetary reward can help push them in that direction. And recent surveys conducted by researchers at the University of California found that monetary payments were one of the strongest motivating factors in getting vaccinated. But equally as powerful was the ability to walk around without a mask and live normally. So if someone doesn't want to get vaccinated, that's a lot harder. That's where the US is using social campaigns and targeted ads and role models to influence the harder-to-budge group of Americans who don't trust the vaccine.
Right, yeah. So there's this thing called social norming. As much as we like to think that we're making our own decisions, the truth is that one of the most motivating factors for all of us is doing what we think everyone else is doing. So, for example, it would make sense to have celebrities become role models.
Exactly. So having Jennifer Lopez, who we heard earlier, at this huge concert in LA earlier this month, that's powerful. And there have also been a few influential Christians also encourage vaccination. They've said to American Christians that they can maintain their biblical and personal integrity while still getting the jab. But we'll have to wait until the 4th of July to see how it goes.
Thanks, Belinda. Belinda Summer is the producer of The Money, our sound engineer, Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Addy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.